This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source for PDF game products, and GamersAttic.com, where you get your physical game products $3 off by using the coupon code RADIO and free swag.
Vorpal Network is the bomb, the cutting edge of geekdom. Comics, advice, D&D, movies, video games, RPGs, finding it easy, just stay calm, VorpalNetwork.com.
This is Ethan.
Jeremy.
And this is Nathan.
From the Gamers Haven podcast, and you're listening to
The Tome.
In ancient times, that book was said to unlock the gates to another dimension, to another race of beings.
Welcome to The Tome Show, episode 107. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to fight off a horde of evil killer frog people who are constantly being picked on by nature? Really? Alright, well anyway, Monster Manual 2. This time, I want to welcome back to the show, Phil Menard of the Chatty DM. Phil?
Hey, how you doing?
I am fantabulous, because today was my last day of work and I'm on summer break.
Yay.
We also have Quinn, the Game Fiend Murphy from At Will.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
And last but not least, we have the fabulous Mike Shea of the Sly Flourish blog.
Howdy, thank you for having me back.
Which got some really good feedback, or some really positive feedback in comments of the last episode you were on.
Oh, great.
Well, I suppose not the last episode, the first episode you were on. Whichever great. Episode it was. People really liked it. You should come back.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And in case people didn't notice, in the previous episode, all three of these folks and many other people were in that show, and it took a lot of work to pull off, so I really want to mention it again and make sure people go back and download it if you haven't done so yet. It was episode 106. It featured James Wyatt and Chris Perkins from Wizards of the Coast, and they talked to us about the first year of 4th edition D&D. I thought it went really well, but if I'm going to get more people from Wizards to come on the show more often, I'm going to need to point to them to that episode and say, look at how many people listen to that. So head to any forums you frequent, Ian World, RPG.net, whatever. Let people know about it. Tell your local game store owner. Maybe they can say, tell people about it. I don't care. Get out and tell people. Tell them now. Do it. We'll wait here. Go on.
And you'll get to know what Chris Perkins really thinks of second edition.
Yes. So yeah, I lied. We're not going to wait. But if you really want, you can go ahead and hit pause and go do that right now. But we all know you're not really going to do that. So, you know, whatever. I guess you all just secretly hate me.
They've all heard it. It was really good.
Good. It was only really good because you guys were on it, though. I've been doing this way too long, and I'm sure I suck by now. Isn't that the way things work? With experience, you get worse.
Maybe so.
Sound very
a little differently than that.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case, tonight's episode is about the Monster Manual 2. This is the sequel to the first Monster Manual for 4th edition. It's written by Rob Hiensu and Steven Schubert. I hope I said Rob's name right. I've heard it multiple times and said it different ways myself. In any case, it's meant to add more variety to your monster selections, give us some classic monsters returned for the new edition, fix some mistakes that they've learned about the game since the first Monster Manual came out, and generally give the DM more things to kill PCs with. But before we get into that, we're going to take a look at our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode is the E-Adventure Tiles Weekly from Skeleton Key Games. They are producing dungeon tile-like PDFs for under $3 and a new one every week. Download, print, and play, because all of your new Monster Manual 2 monsters are going to need a place to kill all those PCs.
I've used their stuff. I haven't actually used their stuff for 4th Ed yet, but I've used it in the past for 3rd Ed. I really love that stuff. So.
Well, and one of the fabulous things about dungeon tile-like products is that they're really, really edition neutral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as it has squares on it, you can use it.
Yeah.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Fat Dragon Games, Green Ronin Publishing, and Wizards of the Coast. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
All right, well, let's go ahead and jump right into our discussion then of Monster Manual 2. We've got a long list of things to talk about, so let's try to fly through as many of these as possible. First of all, we have lots of new creatures that have new sorts of effects. So rather than looking at each individual creature and what they can and can't do, let's talk about some of the general concepts and these effects that they've created. I know I got some information from listening to the official D&D podcast, but I wanted to go a little bit more in depth on some of these things. They seem to try to make more effects that changed the way a monster felt as a whole. So you might have four or five monsters under one category that has similar effects, and that was all sort of meant to tie them together and make them feel like a similar or the, you know, from the same race or what have you.
Yeah, there were actually a lot of effects that I saw that I enjoyed a lot because they help punish players, which I think is something that we don't do enough of in our D&D games. And one that I really liked was the Hero Slaying Hydra's ability to do bonus damage versus people who have marked it. So I thought that was a fun reversal on marking folks.
Or similarly, you've got the Star Spawn, which basically punish all PCs that use healing surges because they're so hungry that they'll jump on you as soon as you try healing yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then I think it's really great that they sort of up the game on monsters for this one, because I found this, and I think other DMs are finding this. Once people realize, and we've had a year for people to realize sort of how to work together as a team and sort of how they can use their powers. And once players click, they become very hard to punish and very hard to deal with. And so having some monsters that are like, gotcha, is nice.
Yeah, there's absolutely. I mean, and one of the things I noticed is that, you know, there are a lot of books out for players now. There's a lot of things that have come out that have really increased the power of players. And there hasn't been as much that I've seen that are help increase the power that DMs hold. And this is the first time where we're getting really getting some nice juicy things to hurt those invokers.
You are. And at the same time, one of the classic monsters that was brought back in this book that traditionally has been the monster to punish players with, I almost feel like is a little bit less threatening than I expected him to be. Specifically, I'm looking at the Rust Monster.
Yep.
Because the Rust Monster doesn't seem to be as dangerous as it was in previous incarnations.
Well, it's one of the things that it's one of the decisions they took about unfun things that players didn't like that they took away. They brought the monster back by refluffing it and then putting new mechanics on it. That's the Rust Monster will destroy your armor or will destroy your sword. You won't lose it as long as you or lose it forever anymore. So it is. I think it's in line with other kind of punishing mechanics from that book, from the particular edition. But when you compare it to cross editions, there's no contest.
Yeah. And I agree. It definitely feels like fourth edition, but it also feels a little bit nerfed.
Yeah, I actually faced it. The first time I saw the Rust Monster was at a D&D game day where I was one of the players, and it was I was a dwarf paladin and immediately lost my armor, I think in like the second round where we faced it, and I never got it back, and the DM, I guess, never threw out there's some bonus armor they had later on in the adventure that I never saw. And it was devastating. What I noticed is it is actually pretty easy for that creature to destroy magic items, that there's not a lot of like the triple saver dies that you see with other creatures. There's, mm-hmm. there's, I think it's basically two hits and then the armor's gone.
Yeah, but it's only once a fight.
It's only once a fight, but yeah, that's enough.
No, of course.
But I wish there was more levels. There's only two level versions of it.
Yeah.
I need a level 15 version.
Quinn?
Oh yeah, no, just it's interesting. You sort of have this quick like marker, like you're in danger, and then you lost it. You know,
yeah, then it's gone. Yeah.
Yeah, it gives you an escape hatch, but you know, you have to sort of be aware. And if you're just like, oh yeah, you know, this thing's not going to get another turn because I'm gonna, and you're gonna be a sad player.
Right. They actually had opportunities to use it elsewhere. One of my favorite monsters in this book is the Bebelith, which has always been one of my favorite creatures in any version of D&D, which has an armor rending power, which is really cool and a lot of, you know, looks like it'll be a lot of fun, and has the option, I mean, you'd think would have the option to destroy armor because it's tearing it to pieces, but it doesn't. You just take minus to AC, and then at the end of the battle, your armor is apparently fine. So they had opportunities to use it more often than they did.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem to take it.
Seems like that would have been a good idea, but at the same time, I almost feel like, you know, like Phil had mentioned, this is one of the losing your items is one of the things that was determined to be less fun in previous editions. And while there's some truth to that, I also feel like there needs to be some real risk, you know? And I'm glad to hear, because I haven't actually run the Rust Monster yet, so I'm glad to hear from what you guys have experienced that it does use that rust ability, and it works. At the same time, I just don't see my players saying, oh crap, it's a rust monster, and just freaking out like they would have in previous editions.
They would if you played it that as soon as it rusted something, the monster is sated and basically runs away. Now there's no way to get your residuum back, and then your players are going to hate you like the old editions, and you make a new adventure of basically hunting overfed rust monsters.
Right. You better give him something of equal or greater value later in the adventure.
Of course.
Well, but punish him in the short term.
You know,
Phil, I like you again now. That was a good one. I like that idea. It eats it and it runs off. That's fantastic.
You cross it with a face spider and you basically give it a teleport ability.
Okay, so let's go ahead and quickly talk about minion roles as well. They changed one little teeny tiny thing on minions that, generally speaking, I think was a good call. Previously, minion was a role. It was a type of creature and a role. In the second Monster Manual, they've decided to make minions have their own separate role besides minion. So you can now have your minion soldier or your minion skirmisher or controller or what have you. Really, for the most part, I guess I felt like it was pretty easy to figure out what your minions were supposed to be doing before, or it wasn't really important because they were there to die.
Mm-hmm.
But it does make it one step easier to create an encounter. So I'm not mad that they didn't do it before, but I think it was a good call to start doing it now.
Oh, yeah.
I don't, one of the secrets that you're going to find out about me is I'm not really a great DM. And for me, I don't use the creature types very much. You know, I don't really pay much attention to whether they're a brute, a soldier. I know the difference, but I don't really pay too much attention other than I know there needs to be a mix.
You haven't been plagued with the grind much, right?
No, I've been absolutely plagued with the grind, yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've learned is when I started using monster rules properly, the grind stopped.
Grind went away. Yeah, I've read a lot about that. And I have, I mean, I do, you know, that said, first of all, I actually play a lot from published adventures, so I'm using their encounters that they've got in the books.
There you go.
Yeah, and they're mixed up, and maybe that's my problem. But one of the things I just noticed is with minions in particular, I mean, I'm throwing a fair number of them out there. I guess I don't really change the encounter type or their behavior based on their type. I pay attention to their stats. You know, I'm looking at, well, what do they gain? You know, I'm looking at the Angel of Light on page 9, which is a 23 minion skirmisher, and what I pay attention to is the fact that it has this death burst. You know, that's interesting, and I want to figure out how I'm going to make the most use of that when it hits the table. What I don't really think about is, well, what does a skirmisher act like? And what am I going to do with that? That's something I don't pay probably as much attention to as I should.
Oh, see, and I do. I look at that little tag, that little role tells me a lot about what I need to look for in that creature and how I'm going to have them act in a fight. It goes a long ways for me. It doesn't tell me everything I need, but if I see, oh, this is a skirmisher, then I know what kind of powers I want to be looking for. And I instantly sort of get a brief idea of, okay, this is sort of how I'm going to move this thing around the field.
Right, and that's something I should probably do more of in my own game. One thing I love about the new minions is that they do more damage. One problem I've always had with minions is, particularly once my players crossed level 11, is that it is really hard to make minions that matter. And a lot of people say, well, they're not supposed to.
Unless, yeah, you basically use them to aid attacks from your brutes.
Well, right, but it seems kind of lame that all of them are basically just grabbing the player's arms and holding them while somebody else comes and beats them up. You know, I would rather actually have them. Because, I always thought that the purpose of a minion is they're actually supposed to, cinematically, they're supposed to be an actual guy. Yeah. You know, they're supposed to be like a normal guy. They have armor and they have weapons and they hit and they do damage. It's just that you don't really track their hit points. You know, you don't track. I mean, they get hit and they go down. Mm-hmm. If that kind of disappears and you basically, you know, all you're doing is aiding another with them, well, you know, there's almost no point to having any of the rest of the stats. But what I'm seeing here is they've really bumped the damage up on them to what it looks like basically three quarters of their level, which is a lot better than I think it was often half of their level or less.
I think they also did some adjustments to the experience point value of minions.
Oh, did they? I didn't even look.
I thought I had read that or heard that somewhere, but I didn't specifically do the math.
There was some chatter on Twitter within Wizards they actually rechanged how many minions you should use per normal creature at Paragon and above, and I think it was 6 at Paragon and 8 at Epic rather than the 4. But I don't know that actually showed up anywhere. I mean, I've been cheating my ass off, and I've just been throwing like 16 minions out there and counting it as one. You know,
yeah, I mean,
it doesn't seem to matter.
No.
Yeah, and I think they've got some good effects on some of the minions here. One of my favorite minion effects there, because it sort of subverts what they are to the players, is death effects.
Yeah.
There.
Right.
So normally you're like, I'm just going to walk into these these minions, kill a bunch of them, you know, put my thumbs up, act like the Fonz, be cool, right? And then, like, you know, you kill one and it explodes, you know, right? I had an encounter a little while ago where they'd, like, kill, like, it was these basically exploding zombies, and they'd kill one, and then there'd be, like, a bunch together in the group, so they'd kill one and they'd set off this chain reaction of explosions. And it was one of the most, like, it was one of the encounters, like, you know, that most freaked my players out. And I had one that was all minions, like, no real guys. But since they exploded like that, they had to actually, like, run around and be careful how they killed them.
Right.
No, I've seen that myself, and at the same time, those effects also have a tendency to slow things down for me sometimes. You know, because then I've got to not, first of all, I have to, as a DM, have to remember.
Now you're actually tracking stuff.
That these guys are doing that. And then, yeah, and then I've got to sit there and stop. You know, you've just successfully killed something. Now let's stop for a moment while I take 15 minutes to have 15 explosions.
Right. But that actually might be a penchant. In the last podcast where we spoke to the WotC people, they told us that in the next Player's Handbooks would be more mechanically challenged for people who are looking for that. And I think that in Monster Manual 2, you've got monsters that are aimed at more experienced DM that are ready to take more complexities in their game.
Yeah, I think
because
that's true.
Fights are growing faster, and then they're getting into the they're really good at it. So that might be one of the options here.
Yeah, and actually looking at this Angel of Light again, one of the things I noticed is it has one of those death bursts where when it dies, it does 10 damage to everybody within. For other angels, they gain 10 temporary, which I think for minions doesn't count. But the other thing is you have to pay attention to the fact that the other minions have Radiant 15 immunities or Radiant 15 resist, so they won't kill each other. And you kind of have to look at three different lines in the same stat block to realize that. And when you're, if you're anything, you know, I spend a lot of time as a DM running around and not really looking too closely sometimes.
Sure.
And it would be easy to miss that and do the chain reaction.
There was a ton of things easy to miss. Just last weekend, I was a player in a game, and we took on a Death Tyrant Beholder. And we more or less defeated it by surrounding it and taking opportunity attacks every time it used an IRA because the DM missed that one little line that said,
they
don't take opportunity attacks from
Yeah,
from
I talked to you
IRAs.
About that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what absolutely destroyed Beholders for me, and I've still, it's been annoying to no end, and I have a great big debate with one of my, one of the players, is the Hospitaller's Blessing power from, it's a Paragon Path for Paladins.
Okay.
And it says that anytime a creature strikes anybody but you, if it's marked by you, anytime it strikes a creature other than you, that creature heals for, like, I think it's 9 to 11 hit points. It's wisdom plus whatever. And I threw a Beholder out there, and nobody in the party ever got hurt. The only thing that happened is somebody got turned to stone, and that was just because it was a, you know, triple save or die. Uh-huh. But everybody else actually ended up better off when they fought it than before, because the Beholder has no choice but to strike other people. Mm-hmm. It has to target multiple people. So that's one of those combinations that just, you know, frustrates me as a DM. But
sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I nerfed it. Now my player's mad.
Anyway, moving along, we have also seen a change in hit point totals. They have changed the hit points for especially solos and elites, which I think is probably a good call. I've sort of been house ruling that myself for some time now, where I've been giving all monsters 2/3 hit points.
Right.
Just to avoid that end of combat grind. Because almost every combat for me went, they see the monsters, they think they're going to die, they almost do die, they pull off a win in the end, and then we spend 15 minutes finishing the combat. Right. You know, it's already over, but we have to finish it for 15 minutes.
Hey, Jeff, if I can go back 1 second on minions, there was one other thing I wanted to bring up, which is something that I've noticed has really helped me with playing the old minions, kind of the new minion way, and that's with doing similar math to what you're talking about with hit points, with minion damage, by increasing the damage of old minions to about 2/3 of level.
Sure.
I've actually upped it to their level, and now I have minions that are actually really dangerous. You know, last night, one of my players was surrounded by 4 minions. 4 of them attacked, all 4 hit, and he took 48 damage. And now, you know, they were like, wow, we actually have to worry about these guys. So that's one nice way to use what they're doing with the Monster Manual 2 and do it for older minions. So I'm sorry to
jump fine.
Back.
No, and going back to, I mean, and that works well as we were talking about those house rules. But going back to the idea of changing these hit point totals, I think it's a good call to do it. It's better to do it than to not do it keep making the same mistake, I guess. But it does seem to have sort of a reverse power creep effect, you know?
Yeah.
The first Monster Manual monsters are now tougher than all the other monsters.
Well, they last longer. Yeah.
Well, right.
Are we seeing that with the elite brutes? We're seeing it with elites as well as solos, or was it just primarily solos?
I've looked at it in the last hour, and solos seem to have about 20% hit points less than their equivalent rolls from the Monster Manual 1. Elites not so much. I've looked at it at level 5, 10, and 20, and they're about the same.
About the same. Yeah, I think it's just solos that they changed the hit point total.
I guess maybe it was wishful thinking, because I think the elites have way more hit points than they need also. I've turned some combats with elites into just real grinds.
Right.
Because you get a lot of hit points by turning creature elite.
Right. Yeah, I've been running, and I think we've talked about it, and I think it's been thrown around on a lot of other areas. There's a house rule that I've been playing with now for about a month and a half that I really like, which is generally reducing monster hit points to 3/4 and increasing their damage by plus half level.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes battles a lot faster, a lot more dangerous, a little bit more swingy, but I kind of don't mind that. And it works well for advanced players, I think. If you've got a group that's really tough and works really well together.
Now, does that cause players to plow through their healing and healing surges faster, and thus bring back the 5-minute workday?
My group is level 14. They just leveled to 15, and last night or over the last 2 weeks, I ran them through 5 full encounters, and they were out of surges at the end, but they had just run out.
Okay.
So it didn't burn them any more than they normally would have been.
I found that with the rules as they exist, in just cutting 2/3 of the hit points, cutting all the hit points down to 2/3,
mm-hmm.
We're still running about 2 to 3 encounters before they have to stop. And
really?
I don't know if my players just aren't very conservative and they just...
Do they have one of those healing belts?
Which one allows you to use 2 healing surges?
No, it's one that you can swap surges from one guy and give it to another.
Yeah. No, they don't.
That changes a lot. I mean, they only get to use it once every encounter, but it's one thing where, like, we have a ranger who hardly ever gets hit, and she often passes her healing surge into it so that fighters get an extra one every battle, and that kind of evens the surge distribution across.
Surge split. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I've seen grind in my games there, but as the sort of games have evolved, one thing that's interesting, and I've never seen this in any edition of D&D ever before, is I have a party you know, got like four players at the table, and charisma is de facto high stat. Right. You know, we have a bunch of guys who like every social skill challenge, you like run through it. And then using that also too, we have like our dragonborn guys who super intimidate there. So like if it's a big encounter with a, you know, a big bad and they just beat the heck out of the thing, he's like, surrender. And it often happens, right? You know, or a lot of times I just have it, you know, I have the guy run, you know, if the players want to pursue.
Right.
You know,
right.
Send him off the map if they want to pursue, do a little skill challenge. Right. Otherwise, he gets, you know, he gets to get away and he gets to come back, you know, if they really sort of like battling him, stuff like that. So I haven't seen, lately, I haven't seen that grind much. And especially as my players have gotten better, you know, I was cutting hit points and they were chewing through the monsters. And I was like, okay, the hit points come back and they're still eating up a lot of the monsters. Yeah. So, you know, it's going to vary, you know, it's going to vary mileage wise. So
yeah,
I'm not sure about them cutting the hit points on it, but
okay.
Hey guys,
I think they probably did it right for the solos, because they were really high, especially the higher level solos were just brutal. They had so many hit points.
Agreed.
And, I haven't actually tried it out of the book yet on doing a mid level, like a mid Paragon level, because it only affects Paragon and above. You know, heroic level, they're the same number of hit points that they always were.
Phil, did you have something to say?
For the grind, more artillery, less brutes.
Yeah.
Good call. Well, and our next several topics are going to deal with looking at some of the ways the story of the game has affected some monsters and some specifics on those monsters. But first, let's take a break and mention our second sponsor of the episode, GamersAttic.com. My ever-appropriate pick of the episode is going to be Monster Manual 2 from Wizards of the Coast, the very book we're talking about now. Normally $35 is less than $29 at GamersAttic.com, and that's before you use the $3 coupon code RADIO that you can use with a purchase of $30 or more, plus get free swag with the order. Plus, if you go there, use the coupon code, and buy something, then they'll see how much they're getting out of their sponsorship of the Vorpal Network and keep supporting the show, which I know you all want to do. So get out there and use it. And if you go through the Tome's affiliate link, which is in the show notes of this episode, the show also gets a small percent of the purchase. So you can support the show twice with one order and support a friendly local game store, which is affiliated with Gamers Attic. So it's really the best of all worlds possible.
Gamers Attic Attack. We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine. Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice within dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them. We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon. What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO. Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for Diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at GamersAttic.com.
And now we're going to chit-chat a little bit about some of the story of some of our new monsters here. First on our list is to look at our good friend Demogorgon. He is on the cover of the book, and so it seems appropriate to chat a little bit about him. He ended up somehow, as they switched to 4th edition, taking a Lovecraftian Great Old One and turning it into his servant with Dagon. I'm not entirely sure how that happened, although honestly, as I read more and more into it, it looks like Dagon is sort of a manipulative puppet master of that situation, so I guess it kind of works.
You haven't seen his bumper sticker? Dagon is my biatch.
But I also really liked some of the sort of the jungle-y, sort of savage feel they've given Demogorgon.
Yeah, he goes from Gnollhead to Baboonhead to Gnollhead to Baboonhead again.
Yeah. and the Baboonhead is always like, well, that always seems a little corny to me. And then they make him this jungle-based demon.
And it's cool.
So it kind of works. I mean, it makes sense. If you're a jungle-based, you know, if your cults are based out of the jungles and what have you, that sort of makes sense. It does sort of seem to limit usage in my mind. You know, I'm not going to use a lot of Demogorgon in civilized lands very often. You know, there's a lot of arc devils and demon lords that can be used in a lot of different environments. It seems like any campaign that focuses on Demogorgon at all and might eventually lead to fighting him is going to be spending a significant portion of their time in the jungle. Otherwise, what's going on here?
So that's basically in line with the Paizo adventure path that featured him.
Yeah, it would be. Any other thoughts on Demogorgon and or Dagon?
I mean, mechanically speaking, I really like how they've tried a new solo mechanic of having multiple actions in the same turn by having each of his head have its own initiative score. It's really well implemented. Really fun.
Did they do something similar with Tiamat?
Maybe. They've done it with a lot of the multi-headed creatures. Yeah. One thing that they do with him, the dual brain mechanic that he has, and this is something where I'm going to go off hopefully in a little, not too long of a rant. One of the things that really hurts me about solos is how easy they are to disable for pretty long periods of time. That the more you get blinds and stuns and dazes, particularly, you know, stuns and dazes, normally you daze a creature and it loses, you know, a couple of actions, but you daze a solo and you lose, like, you know, maybe 7 or 8 actions at once. And a good coordinated group can keep them locked. We call it the bucket on the head, where you've taken whatever giant creature you have and thrown a big bucket on its head and a kick me sign on its ass, and then, you know, you bump it around for, you know, 4 or 5 rounds until it falls over dead. One of the things they did with the dual brain is that it saves against dazed and stunned conditions at the, you know, at the end of each of its turns, and it gets 2.
Yes, it basically it saves. It gets its normal save, plus it gets an extra save on those 3 types of effects.
I think you have a much more rules-savvy group of players than I do.
Yeah, well, I've got a bunch of power gamers, and they love to, like, you know, they love to work the system.
My players have been playing for.
They have a great time, so I have to know that, you know, it's just as viable a way to play as anything else.
Absolutely, and we've been playing the game since 4th edition came out. And I'd say some of our players have gotten good at figuring out certain tricks that their characters can do, but you know, there's not a lot of the. I mean, there's definitely a cohesive team, and people think it's cool when they can get other people to do cool things. But it sounds like your team works very effectively, and my team.
They're smart. They're really tactical guys. But one of the things you have to think about is, you know, Demogorgon, you look at him, he's level 34. I mean, he's going to be facing a party of level 30s.
Yeah,
and if you've looked at level 30s and what they get with their Paragon and their epic abilities and all the powers they get, it's amazing that any level, you know, 30, 34 creature can survive. I mean, Tiamat and you know, the 35s that are in some of the other books, they look pretty tough. But, you know, I don't know. I've seen the level 30 players are really... They've got a lot at their disposal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're hard to challenge.
And speaking of creatures that are supposed to be very challenging, let's talk about our other outsider friends here. I miss Yugoloths. They were an old favorite of mine. And they keep coming back, but they're no longer Yugoloths. And it kind of makes me sad. It's sort of they've been lost as we've lost the Blood War.
What are they now?
Yugoloths were the neutral evil version of...
I was so hoping for a Fiendish Codex 3 to finally have a book on Yugoloths, but I never got it.
Yes, I loved using Yugoloths. I used them. I kept what I used to call in second edition days, I kept my little black book. And it was just my little small 3-ring binder because I had all the little folio sheets that you put in the binder. And that binder was separate. It was just the Yugoloths. And it was great because whenever I pulled it out, and invariably at some point in every campaign, I would pull it out and all of my players would go, "Oh crap, he's pulling out the black book again." And now I lost them, and they're gone. Because everybody knows the Baylor and the Pit Fiend and the Merilith and all those things, and they've studied them up. But the Yugoloth was a lot less heavily used and saw a lot less usage in novels and what have you. And so I thought it was great to pull out because it brought on the unexpected.
Right.
You know, they were the mercenaries of the Blood War. They would fight for either side as long as they found some way for it to be for them.
Is there any version of them in the Monster Manual too?
There is.
There's a Nicodemon.
There's Nicodemon or the Nicodemon is the it used to be the Nicoloth.
Ah, okay.
When it was a Yugoloth, which was their version of the Baylor or the Pit Fiend.
Or the Nicodemon from first edition.
Ah, okay.
Is that what it was called in first?
Yeah.
And yeah, so and there was another example.
Little corner on page 57.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and I think there were. I saw one or two in, was it Manual of the Planes as well? I know a previous book. I saw one or two of them there too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I miss my Yugoloths, and I'm a little.
I hear you,
perturbed,
man.
Yeah. That
I'm sorry.
That they've gone the way of demons.
Yeah. That's what happened.
I feel the same way about the. The same way about the new Pit Fiend. You know, they're just not the same as the old Pit Fiend.
Well, and this is an example. You know, early in the game, when people were like, "Well, sure, there's all these big story changes, but it's just story. You can make the story whatever you want. It's not going to change your mechanics or your rules." Well, this is sort of my example of where it does,
right?
Because the story has dictated that the Yugoloths no longer exist, so they've converted them into demons, which gives them a different feel and different mechanics.
Right.
But in any case. Let's move on to some other creatures that have changed because of the story. And let's talk about metallic dragons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I was told by some people on Twitter never to put in the same room as Rust Monsters.
That'd be a fight.
That would be a... Yeah.
It would look like a shaved cat afterwards.
It may be dangerous just having them in the same book, I suppose. What were they thinking?
Yeah.
Oh, I actually checked it is. I have like a little bit of rust on my Metallica dragon pages. Pretty bad.
There you go.
Blowing.
Well, speaking of dragons, I really like how they're all on a line now. So you can have your bastard brass dragon and your, you know, your child kidnapping silver dragon and whatnot, and just basically piss off all the Dragonlance fans.
That's exactly what I absolutely despise about the new Metallic Dragons.
You liked your good silver dragons?
You've completely changed the dragon. I mean, now...
They can still be good.
They can still be good.
They don't have to be evil.
I'm telling you right now, in my world, they're still all good.
Yeah.
That said, I've created whole characters specifically to point out the fact that just because you're good doesn't mean you can't be a major a-hole.
Right. Right.
So they can still be foes.
They can still be manipulative. Right. Yeah. I think they always were. At least some of them were in books and novels and stuff like that.
I just wish they had challenged DMs or taught DMs how to use them properly rather than just completely change the story. Because now we have a world where the only good things in it are the heroes, which, I suppose they're supposed to be the good guys saving the world. But at the same time, it doesn't feel right to me.
I disagree with you. I think that the design decision behind this was we won't put good monsters in the Monster Manual because heroes won't get to fight them.
Yeah.
So they have angels. Angels are usually on a line. Some of them are good. Yeah. So you basically can have good dragons. It's just you don't necessarily need combat stats for them unless you want to have a Mary Sue or a Marty Stew in your game and have the dragon kill monsters instead of your PCs.
Well, so did you guys ever play Pool of Radiance?
Yeah.
The old gold box game, there was a copper dragon was the boss of that game. So there have been evil copper, you know, there have been evil metallic dragons as long as I've been playing any game of D&D.
Well, there have been dragons who have been... Yeah, every monster always has the exception. But when you put it in the Monster Manual and make them unaligned, that sort of sets the stage as this is the norm.
Right.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be the norm. You know, I understand the idea of you want to be, you know, I like the idea of, you know, and Eberron sort of brought this out as well when it was released, is that you can have good metallic dragons or evil metallic dragons. You know, you can have a good vampire or whatever, you know, it's all shades of gray.
Yeah.
And I can get behind that. But when you put it in the book, and this is the only book that talks about them, and they're all unaligned, that changes the story in a pretty significant way. I'm hoping that when the new Draconomicon comes out, they'll sort of address that issue.
I think they're going to. I think they sort of just laid out the whole ground there, and then they'll go into sort of depth like they did with the other ones, and I would hope so.
And honestly, that's where I'm holding out hope, is that was the plan all along.
If I can dig into the mechanics real quick on these, one of the things that this is a perfect example of the creatures. In fact, I think it's most of them in the book, of the solo creatures that had their hit points reduced, and also their damage has increased quite a bit. Looking at the ancient iron dragon, now its basic attack does 78 plus 9 damage, which is a nice juicy chunk of damage. Uh-huh. But one of the things that really annoys me is in my opinion, looking at the dragons that are in the Monster Manual 1, that they're kind of a mess. And a lot of them I don't play right out of that book anymore, because I think it was the green dragon where, looking at the difference between an adult green dragon and an elder green dragon that's like 10 levels higher, gave one extra point of damage on the breath weapon. Huh. And in all those nine levels, it gained 1 point. But then I look at this book and it's like, oh, they did the dragons so well, but now they're all the metallics. What about my chromatics?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I do, and it's kind of a little cheat, is I'm thinking that I'm just going to use these stats for the chromatics too, and just not tell people.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
That, gold, there's no reason that a gold dragon and a red dragon can't have their stats swapped. And
nobody would even know. Win.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I feel similarly of, and this sort of ties into the change in story, changing the mechanics as well, with the Archons. I look at the Archons in Monster Manual 2, and I start realizing, no, these aren't Archons. These are the old school elementals.
Right.
Right.
Because they don't really have elementals.
Well, like they do have elementals, but they're all a mix of different things.
Right.
And so now I've got elementals, and they just happen to call them Archons.
Right.
I can call elementals and it works the same way they have.
And that's something you can do through. I'm sure everybody else does this. This is nothing new. Is just reskinning your monsters with stats from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this having a whole book where you've got they've now had probably a year of re-engineering of monster stats, and now you basically have an entire book full of new skins new stats that you can reskin old creatures with. Mm-hmm. I plan to do that a lot.
I took a gelatinous cube and I reskinned it as a Zamboni, and it worked. So
yeah, I loved your Zamboni. The Zamboni, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that was so great.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Makes me jealous. I'm never that creative.
That just reaffirms for me, Phil, that we have to get that secret project we were emailing about going.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. Yeah.
Wait a minute. What secret project?
The super secret project that you...
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, that one.
So, in any case, and I guess sort of along the same lines of these are creatures that the story has affected the way they work, we also have the return of the djinn.
Yeah. I love this. I love the retreatment of these guys.
Well, and I do too, and I like that they're there, and I like having – I kind of miss the other types of genies or what have you.
You missed the good ones, right?
Not necessarily, but I tell you what, one of my favorite third edition campaigns or second edition campaigns was in Al-Kadim, and so I have a fondness for genies, but they don't have the ultra powerful abilities that they used to have, because the story is we don't have a wish anymore, so how do you give a wish type power to a monster, and so I kind of miss that, because that's a pretty major story element.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's inherent to the design of the monster manuals in fourth edition. They're not as sort of comprehensive as previous editions, where like in previous monster manuals they're going to tell you everything you want to know about the monster is within that sort of page limit, and they're going to try and cram everything into stats of it.
Needs all that.
Well, and I sort of wish they had maybe made like just a sidebar. Not even make it part of the main part of the stats or any of that, but just a little sidebar over here saying, oh, by the way, the most powerful type of djinn can, alter reality, and this is sort of how you can handle that mechanically if you choose to include it in your story.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I mean, one of the things, and, that, and I know that this has been a core design philosophy for them, is to make all of this stuff table usable, that, you know, you don't, yeah. I mean, and actually you don't quite see that as much with books like the Manual of the Planes and the other ones where it's mainly, you know, they're like textbooks on fantasy worlds. But these, and, you know, the Monster Manual in particular, they really want to make it so that this isn't a book that sits on your shelf and you pull out and peruse. This is a book you have at your table and, you know, mm-hmm. you got sticky notes all throughout it and you're playing right out of the book.
My gut feeling, and I don't know anything about what they're going to do, my gut feeling is that the Monster books are going to focus on crunch with very right. little fluff, and later they're going to publish flavor books on monsters.
Like Open Grave and all those?
No. Those are source books. Even more, maybe like the Monster's Guide to Dragons, or which will basically just go into detail, background story, or Gygaxian naturalism, but nothing... That you, the stuff that you used to see in the second edition Monsters books.
See, I would guess we'll probably see more of that kind of stuff in bestiaries in Dungeon or Dragon magazine.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I think it's going to be insider content.
Yeah.
And they're probably going to make an art cover at the end of a year or two of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, about you guys. I really don't want much of that stuff. I mean, you guys have been playing D&D forever. I mean...
I can make my own stuff.
Yeah, we don't need a lot of books to tell us what our game world is like. We'll make it.
No, yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what. I don't need it for my game, but I like to read it.
Yeah, sure,
you know,
sure.
I've heard the criticism of 4th edition over and over again that it doesn't read fun.
I totally agree. It reads like a phone book.
And I think this is part of the reason why. It doesn't read fun because they took a lot of that fluff out.
And
that's fine. I don't have a problem with that because I don't want to... lug around all that fluff in my bag when I'm going to the game and have to, you know, carry those extra pages of fluff that I don't need. But I don't know, I enjoy reading it, so I don't mind having it somewhere.
That's probably a quiz. When you picked up the original Monster Manual, first edition Monster Manual, and you opened it up and looked at Orcus, did you read the paragraph about his text or did you go right to the stat block?
Stats.
Yeah, stats. Stats for me. Jeff, how about you?
I didn't have a first edition Monster Manual. I started with second edition.
Shame. I started with second edition too. I stole my wife's.
But usually I
started with first and I skipped second, so that explains a lot of my obsession with crunch.
Yeah. Well, and see, usually when I would pick up, even when I pick up older first edition and second edition manuals and what have you, I wouldn't go straight to the first thing that it grabs me about a monster is the picture.
Yeah.
Before I look at anything else, I look at the. You know, I find that when I'm trying to set up an encounter, if I'm just using the books, I'm not on D&D Insider and using their encounter builder, which I've come to rely on. But when I'm just using the books to come up with an encounter, I will flip through the pages of the book and just look at the pictures to try to figure out, is this going to work for the theme of this encounter or not?
Oh yeah,
and then I look at the stats to see if it works.
You don't go at the end of the books. You go into the level that you're looking for to roll, and then you go to the monster. You go with the picture first.
Well, okay, sometimes since 4th edition, sometimes I'll go to the back first, right? But then if there's some things I'm not really sure about, or I need to fill in just a few more here or there, I'll just flip through the book and say, yeah, that looks cool, and then see if it works for what I'm doing.
I think 4th ed has made it really easy to just use the pictures. I mean, it's pretty trivial. I've done just what you're saying a lot. I just, you know, that'll work perfect. Or, you know, sometimes I flip through sort of my minis in another version of that. Yeah. And then you're just like, oh, wow, this scene is, you know, my players are level 5 and this scene is level 18. You know, dump it down, right? And you just, you know, you either reskin it to something else that's level appropriate or you just crank down the levels, done. Absolutely. You know, just pull fast.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and chat a bit about what favorite and least favorite monsters in this book. And let's start off with the negative so we can finish on a high note. Least favorite monsters in Monster Manual 2. Quinn.
I will go.
Okay. Quinn, go.
Huh?
Quinn.
Oh, sure. My least favorite monster here is gonna be, I'm worn on it. And they're sort of, I like them too, but Bullywugs.
Yeah.
I like the monster, but I just don't think I'll ever use this guy. Just, you know, as much as I like the sort of thing of like a race of like Charlie Brown / Ziggies that are like that the universe aligns with you when you beat them up, like that's kind of fun and they're sort of good gag monsters. I have a hard enough time like making my players like sweat these days.
Sure.
With monsters, and Bullywugs just seem to make that even harder for me.
Yeah, and I've sort of felt similarly historically with the Myconids. Not because there's anything particularly wrong with them, and I get the history behind it and all that, but I don't know, the idea of fighting giant mushroom people always rubs me the wrong way.
That's because you weren't born in the 60s.
That's true. Phil, go next.
The monster I like least is the Neogi. I don't know. It's those kinds of hairy, spidery, long neck thingies. Probably there's a story behind it that I don't get.
Spelljammer.
Spelljammer.
I skipped second edition, guys. I'm sorry.
See,
I was playing GURPS during those years.
See, I was going to give Neogi an honorable mention because it's yet another example of Spelljammer making it into the core books. We had the Spelljammers in Adventurous Vault, and now we've got the Neogi coming back. It makes me think more and more that we might be seeing a Spelljammer setting in the future.
It's going to be Dragonlance.
I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see Spelljammer as part of like an insider thing, too.
That might be. Mike, what's your least favorite?
I'm going to go with a Formorian on page 12, 13, 14, and 15. And my main reason is they're ugly. I don't have really good minis for them. I only have like two Formorian minis. And they already put like four pages about Formorians in the Troll Hunt adventure. So I already had a ton of stuff about Formorians, more than I wanted. And now I got four more pages of it when I really could have used four more pages as some other critter.
If you want, take some of your large miniatures and put them in the oven at 250.
Yeah, right.
Well, and the Formorian have always sort of rubbed me the wrong way anyway, because...
just ugly.
Well, they're ugly, and I don't know, I've never really bought into the heavy link to the Fae sort of thing anyway. Yeah. You know, I didn't mind a few pixies running around here and there like we had in previous editions, but I'm still not sure how well I'm settling on this whole Fae wild thing in 4th Ed.
Yeah, we went there in Trollhunt, and it was actually a lot of fun. I really liked it.
It feels a little bit too much trying to appeal to the 12-year-old girls that I teach.
I made it evil.
Good. So my least favorite is the Duergar.
Oh, yeah.
For one reason, I don't understand why they turned into evil porcupines.
Yeah, I hate that. And my players hate it, too.
All of them have this...
The beard quills.
There are no reasons for it,
right,
yeah.
The infernal quill power, which is...
Ridiculous,
just,
yeah.
They've got red spines coming out of their beards or their hair or whatever, and
that's
a pretty big shift in their story.
Right.
And as a race, and they just don't feel the same.
It's just dumb.
Yeah.
It's another one where they used up four pages on monsters that I've already played to death when I ran Thunderspire.
Yeah, right. And I never want to run them again.
Well,
I'm done with them. Yeah.
And I look at them and I think, you know, this could work as like a clan of Duergar that got into something, or as one Duergar that has this ability. But I don't know why red porcupine quills coming out of their beard has to be a theme for the entire race now, and it just feels wrong to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's look at favorites. I'm going to make Phil go last this time because he and I are fighting over whose show this is. So, Mike, what's your favorite?
There's a lot. I really like the Bebelith. I really like the Hero Slaying Hydra, but I think I'm going to go with the Shardarkai. The Shardarkai are quickly becoming my new Dark Elf. You know, now Dark Elves are kind of they're everybody loves them, and Drizzt ruined them, so I don't really think they're as evil as. You know, they're not as cool as they used to be, but the Shardarkai are quickly falling into that area.
Yeah.
And on page 80 and 81, we have an entire page of four different Shardarkai all around the mid-tier Paragon level. And the pictures of them are great. They look really tough.
And that's an add-on to the Shardarkai we've already had.
Yeah, we already have a bunch of Shardarkai.
So now we've got a huge variety of them.
One thing I want to try is I actually want to take these four stat blocks and give them to players and run a mini campaign or mini adventure where they run four Shardarkai that have to go through some evil adventure out in the Shadowfell.
The idea of running a Shardarkai has always sort of appealed to me, and I've started liking them since towards the end of third edition. I really got turned on to Shardarkai and started using them more and more. And you like them. One of the reasons it sounds like you like them is one of the same reasons that I picked my favorite. And I went a little bit different. I went with something a little less flashy. I like the humans.
Yeah,
There's a lot of them. They're nice.
There are
insane humans.
There are 14 different types of humans introduced, from levels 5 to 23,
including pirates, man.
Pirates. And
with guns.
How easy would it be to take these and reskin them as any humanoid race, but have the feel that you need to? I mean, the human entry, while a little bit less flashy, is really, really useful and very practical.
Yeah, right. Very, very practical. I agree.
It's sort of the same reason I like dwarves. They have their racial power isn't as flashy, you know, being able to use that second wind as a miner, but it's really practical.
So can we hope to get human ninjas in the next Monster Manual?
I would assume so.
And it'll be complete.
Quinn, what's your favorite monster?
I've been divided on this whole time. Can I be a wimp and give like two? Because I can't pick one.
If you can
say
do it
no,
quick,
say no, say no.
I can do it very quickly.
Phil says no. So I'm going to say yes.
First, the Star Spawn. I just think I personally love the whole Star Pack flavor that they have. And the Far Realm kind of stuff, and then these monsters. My favorite out of them is the Maw of Akamar. It's just really, really freaking cool. Like a large being made out of like a small mini universe kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Awesome. Second one, may be a little weird, might not, the Kenku. And the Kenku, for the simple reason, I mean, they've got all the sort of like great like little group mechanics. Mimicry. Mimicry is a power designed like, you know, out of like combat to give players health, right? Like you can do so much stuff with mimicry that is just ridiculous. And I'm
it's
going
like
to
a little skill challenge built right into him.
Yeah, you can do skill challenges like trap the whole nine yards. It's so expansive and so awesome.
Although once again, I'll point out that for some reason the Kenku get to be the exception to the rule. Nobody else gets to have out of combat powers listed in the Monster Manual. But the Kenku do.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Nobody does?
Well, my little diatribe about things like the genies not having wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Phil?
Yeah.
I know we're fighting, and I know that I'm just jealous because you're two-timing on me with the Open Design podcast, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, I was scooped by Quinn, so the star of that book for me were Star Spawn, the whole Cthulhu feeling of the monsters, and the way, mechanically speaking, that they were implemented makes me want to play one probably tomorrow. Problem is my players are level 9. level 15, no problem.
Okay.
So, no.
Good.
Favorite monsters.
Good, then. Let's go ahead and do a quick review of what we've talked about. We've talked about some of the new effects in the game. And generally speaking, I think we liked a lot of the new effects, although we discussed how the monsters in Monster Manual 2 seem to be a little more complex to run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We talked about minions and how they now have roles and how that's probably a good thing. And some of the other minion changes have been positive in terms of amount of damage they do and their ability to do special effects as well as just damage. We've had a discussion on the hit point totals of solos being changed and some discussion of whether or not it's a good idea to change the hit point totals of everything. Because if you have Mike's party of players, they chew through monsters like crazy. And if you have my party of players, they almost die in every encounter. We also chatted about some story changes that affects mechanics when we talked about Demogorgon, Dagon, the long-lost Yugoloth that I miss so much, and the evil metallic dragons, or at least unaligned. And then we listed our favorites and least favorite monsters in this book. And we seem to like some of our Cthulhu-like Star Spawn. And adding variety into the game with more Shatterkai and humans. We didn't like some of the changes that didn't make any sense, like the fact that Duergar have red spiky quills on their face now. And I think that more or less summarizes what we talked about. Anything else I missed?
Everything's fine.
Sounds good.
Great book.
All right. That is our look at Monster Manual 2. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, and more of you should probably be doing that. I am officially on summer break now, so if you don't email me, I will get lonely. Don't forget about my plea to tell people about the show. Reviews on iTunes help. But get out there and let people know about it. Why don't more people listen to podcasts? A lot of people don't get them. Why don't they get them? Because you haven't shown them the way yet. Go out there. Show them the way. And of course, you can support the show by visiting our RPG Shop affiliate link. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps pay the bills. Or if you'd rather stick with the Amazon store, it is still up as well. Links for things mentioned in this show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com, including links to these fine gentlemen's blogs. Quinn Murphy, the Game Fiend, where can we find you?
You can find me on at Will. It's @well.omnievangelist.net.
And Phil, where can we find you?
At chattydm.net.
And on the Open Design Podcast. And Mike, where can we find you?
Slyflourish.com and twitter.com/slyflourish.
Very good. This has been Monster... This has been Monster Manual 2, episode 107 of...
The Tome. I'm on the wall.